You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for May 6th. Will Hansen from Drake University. Here is our first story. The first article we're reading is State Test Long-Term Care Facility Employees at Mid-America Center in Council Bluffs by Mike Brownlee. This was posted today, May 6th. The article starts, employees from long-term care facilities in Council Bluffs area stopped by Mid-America Center Tuesday for COVID-19 testing. The effort, part of an increased surveillance testings at long-term care facilities across the state, continues today with about 1,500 people expected to be tested, according to Sam Otto with the Iowa Army National Guard, who serves as a public information officer for the Guard's Western Iowa Task Force. The Guard handled logistics at Council Bluffs testing site, which was operated by the Iowa Department of Public Health. The Governor's Office of Mid-America Center Testing was not part of the Iowa Testing Initiative, which is working to set up drive-through sites across the state. The healthcare department said nursing home employees underwent two tests, diagnostic testing to check if the person had COVID-19, and serology testing to check for coronavirus antibodies in the blood. It's nice to have that peace of mind, Tiffany Flanagan, a nurse at Bethany Lutheran Home, said after being tested, that we are protecting ourselves and our residents. Asked about the swab used for the diagnostic test, which is inserted into the nose, Flanagan's colleague, Nurse Katie Shia, said, "Not bad at all. Nothing compared to the video," she said, referencing popular videos of the test and patients' reactions afterward. Abby Zila with Hanson House said she was happy to know the state is increasing testing for the long-term care employees. "It's great," she said. "I'm glad they're providing testing, especially for the nursing homes now." During Iowa Governor Cameron Olds' daily live-streamed press conference on Tuesday, she noted that 56% of Iowa's 207 COVID-19-connected deaths were long-term care facility residents. There have been 28 outbreaks at such facilities in 12 Iowa counties. "Preventing COVID-19 from impacting long-term care facilities is extremely challenging," Reynolds said. "Nursing homes across the state have taken precautions to combat COVID-19, including restricting visitors. The hardest is seeing residents without visitors. That's the sad piece," Shia said. "A lot of people are understanding what we have put in place and grateful that we are looking out for their loved ones and doing everything we can to keep them healthy," Flanagan added. The surveillance effort will significantly increase testing in Pottawatomie County. According to the state, there have been 767 tests in the county as of Monday at 10 a.m. Iowa updates coronavirus.iowa.gov daily with numbers from the previous day. The county announced 3 new positive cases on Tuesday, bringing the county's total to 62. Testing at the MAC, by appointment only, continues today. The next story we will be reading is Chamber Releases Survey of COVID-19 Pandemic's Impact on Businesses. This is by John Liu, and it was posted May 6, 2020. The Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce has released the results of an early survey of COVID-19 pandemic impacts on Pottawatomie County businesses. Tom Hanifan, President and CEO of the Chamber, said the survey was sent to 317 businesses representing at least 7,321 employees in late March. The research project was conducted by the University of Northern Iowa's Institute for Decision-Making and Strategic Marketing Services. Hanifan was quick to note the survey was conducted during the state's earliest efforts to mitigate the impact of the pandemic and before the actual impacts of the outbreak on Iowa's economy were widely known. But even in those early days of the pandemic's presence in Iowa, 83.6% of 317 respondents anticipated the COVID-19 outbreak would negatively impact their organization. Just over 9% of those responding to the survey said they were unsure of the outbreak's impact, 4.1% said the outbreak would have no impact, and 3.2% felt like the impact would be positive. Of those responding to the survey, 23.4%, said they had just one or two employees. 19.6%, reported they have 3 to 5 employees. 55, or 20.8%, reported 6 to 11 employees. 54 or 20.4% reported 12 to 30 employees, and 42 or 15.8% reported 31 or more employees. At the time the survey was conducted, 31% of respondents said the outbreak had impacted employment, and 50.5% said it had impacted revenue. Looking down the road, 30 days from the time of the survey, 39% anticipated an impact on employment, and 53.2% anticipated an impact on revenue. Looking out 60 days from the time of the survey, 33.7% expected the outbreak would have an impact on employment, and 51.2% anticipated an impact on revenue. Looking out even further, 32% expected to see an impact on employment in 90 days, while 47.7% anticipated ongoing revenue impact. In terms of top concerns at the time of the March survey, 81.1 listed financial impact on operations and or liquidity and capital. 64.7% shared concerns about decreasing consumer confidence and spending. 31.1% shared concerns about global recession. 26.5% listed workforce reduction. 22.4% mentioned supply chain disruptions. 19.2% listed lower productivity. And 15.5% pointed to the lack of information for decision making. More than half of the respondents, 54.3%, responded that employee restriction had been implemented at the time of the survey. 31.2% said no restrictions have been implemented, and 12.6% said restrictions were not applicable. The most frequent type of employee restrictions included closed business or organization, 30.9%, working from home or remotely, 297, or I believe it's 29.7%, reduced staff layoffs or furloughs, 25.5%, social distancing, 23%, restaurant takeout and pickup only, or bank drive-up, 18.2%, canceled meetings and events, 15.8%, travel ban and reduced travel, 13.3%, reduced access, no customers, suppliers, vendors, volunteers, patients, or visitors on site, 12.7%, self-quarantine, 11.5%, and reduced or eliminated external programming, 8.5%. The late March survey found 33.2% of the workforce was eligible to work remotely, and 20.6% of the workforce was working remotely at that time. Nearly 28% of those who responded to the survey said their policies allowed employees to work remotely without using sick leave and or vacation days. 27.4% said employees may take accrued paid sick leave and or vacation days if they choose or are required not to come back to work. And 26.2% said they offer no pay for employees who chose or are required not to come to work. Hannafin said he anticipates the survey will be repeated in the coming weeks. Fairway offers second round of gift cards by John Liu. This was posted May 6, 2020. For the second time in as many weeks, Fairway Stores Incorporated has provided funding to assist those who have been laid off or furloughed as a result of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. In April, Fairway announced a $200,000 donation to the Iowa Chamber of Commerce Executives, ICCE. The donation provided for $1,000 to $2,000 in gift cards to the ICCE Chamber of Commerce members in the communities Fairway serves. The Council Bluffs Area of Chamber of Commerce applied for a $2,000 grant from the ICCE and initially received 40 gift cards valued at $50 each, which were distributed to Chamber's members, employees who had been laid off or furloughed. With the announcement of the availability of additional Fairway funding, the local chamber applied for additional cards. On Tuesday, Tom Hannafin, Chamber President and CEO, said the chamber has received 20 additional gift cards valued at $50 each that are being mailed to chamber members, employees who have been laid off or furloughed. That is the end of that article. Forecast: chance of rain today, partly sunny skies, by Mike Brownlee. This was posted today, May 6, 2020. Rain's in the forecast for much of the next few days. Today, there's a 20% chance of precipitation before 1 p.m. according to the National Weather Service in Valley, Nebraska. The high today is 62 degrees with a low of 42. Thursday brings even a higher chance of rain at 50% during the day and 60% in the evening with a high of 60 and low of 40. Here's the upcoming forecast from the Weather Service. Wednesday, a 20% chance of showers before 1 p.m., partly sunny with a high near 62, north-northwest winds, 7 to 10 miles per hour. Wednesday night, partly cloudy with a low of around 42, north wind 5 to 7 miles per hour, becoming calm in the evening. Thursday, a 50% chance of showers, mostly cloudy with a high near 60, light and variable wind. New precipitation amounts of less than a tenth of an inch possible. Thursday night, showers likely, mainly before 1 a.m., mostly cloudy with a low of around 40. Chance of precipitation is 60%. New precipitation amounts between a tenth and a quarter of an inch possible. Friday, sunny with a high near 58. Friday night, mostly clear with a low around 37. Saturday, mostly sunny with a high near 68. Saturday night, a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms before 1 a.m., mostly cloudy with a low of around 45. Sunday, partly sunny with a high near 61. Sunday night, clear with a low around 39. Monday, a slight chance of showers, mostly sunny with a high near 61. For our next article, we are going to be reading Pottawatomie County reports 3 new COVID-19 cases. This was written on May 6, 2020 by Mike Brownlee. Two Council Bluff residents and an Oakland resident have contracted COVID-19, the latest cases in Pottawatomie County. Statewide, Iowa reported a single-day high of COVID-19 deaths, 19 on Tuesday. Governor Kim Reynolds announced the deaths, which brings the state total to 207 during her daily live stream press conference. The state has also reported 408 additional positive cases of COVID-19, the disease caused by coronavirus. Combining the state and county numbers, there have been at least 10,114 positive cases in Iowa. Pottawatomie County has 62 confirmed cases of the disease caused by the coronavirus, according to Pottawatomie County Public Health. Of those, there have been 2 deaths, 26 have recovered, and 33 are isolating at home, and 1 is hospitalized. The 3 new cases were tested for COVID-19 between April 29th and May 2nd. The department said one individual is 18 to 40 years old, and 2 are 41 to 60 years old. One of the individuals has pre-existing conditions. 2 of the new cases had contact with an existing COVID-19 case, and 1 is a result of community spread. All 3 individuals are self-isolating at home. According to the state COVID-19 website, coronavirus.iowa.gov, there have been at least 767 tests conducted in the county. Pottawatomie County Public Health said it continues to conduct contact tracing investigations for each COVID-19 case. As part of contact tracing is assessing the risk to the general public. If there is not a risk to the general public, public health will communicate directly with specific contacts identified in the investigation. If and when a risk to the general public health is identified, public health will publicly identify the location and communicate any actions to the public should take, county officials said in a release. Crawford County's number of cases jumped from 78 to 96 based on state data. Crawford County Public Health Director Kim Feenerin said the county has increased testing. We are working with the state to bring testing to town for manufacturing and long-term care facilities, Feenerin said, or told Nonpareil. There have been 96 confirmed cases in the county, with 22 recoveries and 1 death. There have been 205 tests in the county, according to the state. Denison, the county seat, is home to multiple meatpacking plants, which, along with long-term care facilities, have been hardest hit by the disease. Finneran said that she was unable to discuss if there have been positive cases at the plant. Nearly 1,400 workers at 3 Tyson Food pork processing plants in Iowa have tested positive for the coronavirus, the state reported Tuesday. The Iowa Department of Public Health revealed for the first time that the state's largest workplace outbreak had been at Tyson's plant in Perry in central Iowa. There have been 730 workers were confirmed to have the virus, a startling 58% of those who tested, the department said. The Tyson plant in Waterloo had 444 workers test positive, and its Columbus Junction plant had 221 confirmed infections, the department said. The department said that 258 workers at National Beef Plant in Tama tested positive, as did another 131 employees of a Newton Wind turbine blade plant owned by TPI Composites. Sarah Reesetter, Iowa Department of Public Health Deputy Director, said during Reynolds' conference that the state medical director was using her legal authority to release the locations and scope of those five workplace outbreaks after determining the information was in the public interest. The department defines an outbreak as a workplace in which 10% of employees are sick or absent. Elsewhere in southwest Iowa, Harrison County reported a 17th case late Monday, a woman between 18 and 40 years old. Harrison County Home and Public Health said the woman is hospitalized. The department said anyone who believes they may have been exposed to the virus at Empower Family Wellness, 202 East 7th Street in Logan on April 28th and April 29th, should self-isolate for 14 days from the date of the potential exposure and monitor for symptoms. Two of the Harrison County cases are in isolation. While there have been 15 recoveries in the county, there have been 161 people tested in the county. Mills County announced two additional cases, putting the county total at five, with three recoveries. There have been 115 county residents tested, according to coronavirus.iowa.gov. Elsewhere in southwest Iowa, according to the state COVID-19 website, Shelby County, 12 cases, 9 recoveries, 98 tests. Montgomery County, 1 case, 1 recovery, 112 tests. Page County, 9 cases, 5 recoveries, 291 tests. Cass County, 1 case, 1 recovery, 127 tests. Monona County, 10 cases, 7 recoveries, 124 tests. Fremont County, 0 cases, 47 tests. During the press conference, Reynolds said there were 3,000 additional negative tests for a total of 50,458, with 60,569 tests conducted in the state. 1 in 52 Iowans have been tested. Of those affected, 3,572 have recovered. And Regional Medical Coordination Center, Region 4, which includes Pottawatomie, Mills, Harrison, Cass, Crawford, Shelby, Fremont, Montgomery, Page, Adams, Audubon, and Taylor counties, there have been 3 patients hospitalized with COVID-19. There are 3 with 2 in intensive care, according to the coronavirus.iowa.gov. The region has 209 inpatient beds available, 40 intensive care unit beds available, and 66 ventilators available. There are no patients on ventilators in the region. Region 4 remains at a 6 on the state's 12-point COVID-19 severity scale. In Council Bluffs, Hy-Vee will limit meat sales at its metro area stores starting Wednesday. The company said it is putting a limit on consumer meat purchases because of worker shortages at meatpacking plants, as well as an increase in meat sales, noting customers sometimes have not been able to find items they're looking for. Because of this, we are going to put a limit on customer purchases in the meat department, the company said in a release. Effective Wednesday, each customer will be limited to 4 packages of combination of fresh beef, ground beef, pork, and chicken at all Hy-Vee locations, the company said. That is the end of this article. Our next article, Council Bluffs Chamber Offering Business Webinars, by John Liu. This was also posted on May 6, 2020. The Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce is offering a pair of webinars this week that should help answer questions being raised by area business owners. Both webinars are open to the public and do not require chamber membership. From noon to 1 p.m. on Thursday, the chamber will host a launch and learn webinar featuring representatives of Iowa Workforce Development and Iowa Legal Aid. Business owners will be able to ask questions about unemployment claims, employees' safety and business liability, workmen's compensation, and other liability concerns when reopening businesses. Those who wish to participate in the webinar can register at the Chamber website, councilbluffsiowa.com, or on the Chamber's Facebook page to receive a link to the Zoom meeting. At 1 p.m. Friday, the Chamber, the City of Webster City, and Advanced Southwest Iowa will host a webinar conversation with Debbie Durham, Director of the Iowa Economic Development Authority and Iowa Finance Authority, regarding financial aid during the current COVID-19 pandemic. As with the Thursday webinar, those who wish to participate in the webinar can register at the Chamber's website, www.councilbluffsiowa.com, or on the Chamber's Facebook page to receive a link to the Zoom meeting. Registrants will receive an email containing the Zoom link and an opportunity to post questions that will be asked of Durham. That is the end of this article. The next article is a short one. It's about Hy-Vee to limit meat purchases. This is also by Mike Brownlee, and it was posted May 5th of 2020. Hy-Vee will limit meat sales at its metro area stores starting Wednesday. The company said it is putting a limit on customer meat purchases because of the worker shortages at meatpacking plants, as well as an increase in meat sales, noting customers sometimes have not been able to find the items they're looking for. Because of this, we're going to put a limit on the customer purchases in the meat department. Effective Wednesday, each customer will be limited to 4 packages of combination of fresh beef, ground beef, pork, and chicken when they check out at all Hy-Vee locations, the company said. The next article we'll be reading is Iowa's Chris Doyle doesn't believe players should be rushed back. This was posted by Steve Batterson on May 5th, 2020. Safety and wellness of participants should guide how to return to competition is structured for college football teams. As the players train on their own and uncertainty remains surrounding when on-campus work will resume, Iowa strength and conditioning coordinator Chris Doyle said players should not be rushed back into game action. The steeper the curve as far as getting back to training, the more risk involved, Doyle said during last week's video conference. Doyle echoed Iowa Hawkeye coach Kirk Ferentz in suggesting that 8 weeks of preparation, 4 designated for strength and conditioning work, and 4 for preseason practices is optimal. Ferentz said in a video conference last month that 6 weeks is doable, but he's hopeful for 2 additional weeks as well. I remain hopeful that whenever they set the date for the start of the season, we will have at least 8 weeks to get our team pulled together and some semblance of game readiness, Ferentz said. 4 weeks specifically for strength and conditioning staff, and then 4 weeks more in football mode. But a return to competition and day-to-day work preceding that point in time is only part of the equation. Doyle said safety concerns include making certain that weight rooms, locker rooms, and training areas remain clean to help prevent the spread of COVID-19 coronavirus, which has halted all team activities throughout college football since mid-March. We're going to address some things from the hygiene perspective, Doyle said. There will be some unique challenges there when you bring a number of guys into the locker room or a weight room. Doyle said a number of possible scenarios remain in the discussion stage, including the possibility of training taking place in small group settings. Certainly, there will be janitorial staff available immediately upon completion of workouts, he said. We're going to need a really thorough plan, which we are currently working on. Sports medicine and personnel and coaches are involved in these conversations, designing return to play and return to training protocols. There is something we take very seriously, the safety and wellness of our athletes. That will be at the forefront of our minds as we plan, and will certainly follow the directions of the experts and the medical community as how we go about it, Doyle said. College administration have discussed multiple scenarios for the upcoming season, including the possibility of a delayed start or shifting the entire 2020 schedule into the spring schedule beginning in February. Ferentz said during a video call that he would see no problem with a late starting season running through late December. He had more concerns and plenty of questions about the spring season that would be followed just months later by the 2020 regular scheduled 2021 season. Doyle said those concerns include the absence of needed recovery time at the end of one season to the beginning of another. The challenges will exist when you're looking at 18 to 22-year-old athletes playing 2 full seasons in a very short time window, Doyle said. That's concerning. Typically, we play 12, 13 games in a 12-month period, and you're talking about doubling that. He said cutting training time in half and doubling the exposure to competition only adds potential risk. This That is among the areas of discussion as of how the 2020 season, football season, might be structured and remains an unknown. Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren suggested Monday that the next 6 to 8 weeks will be paramount in determining if the season will begin on time in early September. There are some states opening up, even as early as today. We'll be watching closely, Warren said in an interview with the Big Ten Network. Are the COVID-19 incidents, are they spiking? Are they stable? And are they going down? He said safety of all involved parties will be at the core of any decision he makes, and conversations will include discussions with administration, coaches, student athletes will factor into the outcome. I think as we get into the early part of June, we will be in position that we will be able to make a tangible decision, Warren said, adding that he preferred to avoid any speculation on possibilities. While a lot remains fluid, there are some knowns. The Big Ten Monday announced an extension of its previous suspension of all organized team activities for intercollegiate programs through June 1st because of concerns surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic. The previous suspension, which prohibits everything from individual and small group workouts to full team activities, has been in place since March 13th and has now been extended twice. It is an additional measure to the previously announced cancellation of athletic competition for the remainder of the current academic year, a moratorium on all on and off campus recruiting activities. In the statement, the Big Ten indicated the suspension would be reevaluated on June 1st. That is the end of this article. You're listening to the IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, May 6th on IRIS, the Iowa Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Will Hansen from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Now we will be reading a few opinion pieces or opinion columns. This one is a column. It is A Pork Panic Won't Save Our Bacon. It was posted by Amanda Little on May 3rd, 2020. Last Tuesday night, President Donald Trump signed an executive order that could shield meat producers from lawsuits waged by workers who have contracted COVID-19. The orders also pressure meat processing plants to remain open to ensure a continued supply of protein to Americans and to reverse unnecessary closures. This is reckless and an uninformed move. Even as threats to the global food supply increase, along with the cost of plant closures, the lives of thousands of workers could be imperiled if these facilities rush to reopen. The plant could also backfire, causing large-scale, long-term global food supply distribution that make the current plant closures look trivial. 16 major poultry, pork, and beef processing centers in the U.S. closed in recent weeks and after they became COVID-19 hotbeds, including the Smithfield Food Processing Plant, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, the Tyson Chicken Processing Center in Waterloo, and the Cargill Meat Plant in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. As of April 28th, there are more than 4,135 reported COVID-19 cases tied to 75 meat processing plants in 25 states, according to the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Among the infected workers, 18 have died across 9 states. Pork production has been hit the hardest. Nearly half of all hog processing in the U.S. is currently offline, whereas poultry and beef production have barely dipped. The story of the Smithfield facility in Sioux Falls, which processes 5% of the pork produced in the United States, is a cautionary tale about the risks of operating a plant with sickened employees, and it bears out key criteria for safe reopening. Under normal conditions in the Sioux Falls plant, 20,000 hot dogs a day, 1,300 per hour, are slaughtered and rendered into chops, strips, joint, loins, and ground meat. The workers here do fast-paced, shoulder-to-shoulder work, often in warm, wet conditions, the kind of environment that increases the risk of communicable diseases. Until the facility was shuttered on April 11th, it was the number one COVID-19 hotspot in the United States. Even now, as the plant lays dormant, it remains the country's top hotspot. Nearly a quarter of the plant's workers, about 900 of the 3,700, have contracted the virus, as have hundreds of the employees' family members. Labor leaders who represent the workers at the Sioux Falls plant are balking at Trump's executive order and condemning a statement made on Monday by South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem on Fox News that she wants to reopen the Smithfield plant in a matter of days. Mustafa Colombo, a longtime line worker for Smithfield who represents the plant's employees at the local labor union, United Food, and commercial workers, says the governor is showing little regard for the lives of the workers. "We would like to come to work, but how will we if it's not safe for us?" he told me in an interview. Colombo wants Noem and Trump to put the lives of workers and our families into consideration before they rush out to force the company to reopen. Trump's executive order may also encourage plant operators to cut corners on the CDC's safety recommendations. Last week, the CDC conducted an inspection on the Sioux Falls plant that produced a 15-page report with recommendations for Smithfield management and the South Dakota Department of Health. The report underscores the importance of testing workers before they return to the facility, of providing proper PPE for every employee, and of reforming plant operations to allow for social distancing. Yet Colombo said, "We have got no guarantee that any of these recommendations will be met." Colombo applauds Smithfield for inviting the CDC to conduct its inspection and for agreeing to give its employees 2 weeks of full wages and benefits through May 1st. But he estimates that it will take at least 4 to 5 weeks to implement the CDC recommendations before the plant is reopened, during which time the workers and their families should remain in quarantine and continue to receive company support. There's good reasons to believe that it will take weeks, not days, before the plant operators can fully meet safety recommendations, if they can be met at all. The CDC recommendations are to begin with voluntary. Cooper Caraway, the president of the Sioux Falls AFL-CIO, told me that the report goes out of its way to say that its recommendations are not enforceable by law. And on April 26th, the CDC quietly announced on its website that critical infrastructure workers, who include meat and poultry processors, may be permitted to continue work following potential exposure to COVID-19, provided they remain asymptomatic. The statement is confounding, given that the CDC has acknowledged that COVID-19 can be transmitted by carriers who show no symptoms. Comprehensive testing is the only way to ensure that workers with COVID-19 don't spread the disease, but it's highly unlikely that thousands of tests can be obtained, let alone administered, in a matter of days if Smithfield rushes to reopen. It's also unlikely that the plant will get adequate PPE. The Food Safety and Inspection Service has already tried to place large orders for PPE and hand sanitizer for federal food inspectors, yet the delivery keeps getting pushed back. Internally, plant workers have been asking for increased PPE and social distancing measures since early March, to no avail. Smithfield mishandled the early stages of the outbreak, says Colombo. As a result, there's now so much fear and hurt among our workers and so little trust. The Sioux Falls plant is known to be one of the most diverse in the nation. The employees speak 40 different languages, mostly Spanish, Nepalese, Swahili, Amharic, and hundreds of different dialects. They have been getting early warning calls from their families in Asia, Europe, and across the African continent as the pandemic spread overseas. Union leaders pushed management to do temperature checks, increase sanitizer stations, implement social distancing, and schedule breaks. Management drug its feet. They didn't think it was necessary, says Caraway, adding that Smithfield offered a $500 responsibility bonus to any worker who didn't call in sick during the month of April. It was very a tone-deaf way of addressing a pandemic, he says. Now Trump's executive order further disempowers the 900 Smithfield employees and their family members who have contracted COVID-19 by limiting their ability to recoup the cost of their illness via lawsuits. Smithfield, as well as Noem, blamed the spread of the disease not on what was happening inside the plant, but rather on employees' close-knit lifestyles, a notion Colombo found disrespectful and discriminatory. "Blaming employees who are essential to your organization is ungrateful. We invest our lives, our time, and our energy, our everything, in our jobs. The governor of our state and the company we work for have insulted our dignity," he says. There's no question that Noem who has not implemented a stay-at-home order nor a temporary ban on evictions and foreclosures in her state, is motivated by fears of an economic freefall. The Smithfield plant is one of the largest engines of the GDP in the region, producing 18 million servings of pork a day, and it hemorrhages revenue every hour it's off. And Six Falls Mayor Paul Ten Haken says disruption is rippling up and down the supply chain, especially among the 550 hog farmers who sell their animals to the Smithfield plant. "I bet I got 24 calls to my office yesterday from hog farmers," one said. "Mayor, I had to shoot and kill 3,000 hogs today because there was no market for them right now." Ten Haken added that Sioux Falls City landfill is now having to alter operations and accept euthanized pork. Pork farmers face the terrible specter of having to euthanize their animals by the tens of thousands in the coming weeks. "This is a food crisis in its own right and must be coordinated effort at the local, state, and national level to help these producers redirect their animals to local meat lockers, food banks, and many processing facilities nationwide that are still safely operating. But we need to be wary of claims by meat industry executives that a global food security crisis is not. The food supply chain is breaking," wrote Tyson Foods chairman John Tyson in a full-page ad on Sunday. He cautioned that millions of pounds of meat will vanish from groceries, and millions of animals, chickens, pigs, and cattle will be depopulated because of the closure of our processing facilities. Let's be clear. U.S. consumers will not be forced to go vegan anytime soon. The threats of protein production are real, but meat companies have large reserves of products in cold storage that can temporarily fulfill demand while plants remain offline. Forcing coronavirus-affected meat plants to stay open is hardly the solution to an emerging crisis. Instead, it will only deepen it. Smithfield will not grant my request for an interview, but in a public statement, the company CEO, Ken Sullivan, stressed his obligation to help feed the country now more than ever. "We have a stark choice as a nation. We're either going to produce food or not, even in the face of COVID-19. This is short-sighted. Sullivan's primary responsibility is not to his consumers, but rather to the health and well-being of his employees, without whom none of his food can be produced. Trump's executive order empowers his Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, and meat companies to carry out his directives. In the coming weeks, the decisions made by Perdue, Ken Sullivan, John Tyson, and other industry leaders will define the future of the industry. They must produce with great care and caution. They must ask bacon-loving consumers like me to adapt their near-term reality of lower volumes and higher-cost meat. Chances are good that most of us, especially those in higher-income brackets, can survive with fewer hot dogs and sausage patties for a few months. We might even be better for it. If instead the president and meat industry leaders panic, if they force plant workers to operate in unsafe conditions so that huge volumes of low-cost meat can continue to flow to global consumers, we'll be looking at a future waves of plant shutdowns far more economically devastating than the cost of getting it right now." Next, we will be reading the obituaries from Wednesday, May 6, 2020. First, Judith Camp. Judith L. Judy Camp, age 75, of Council Bluffs, passed away peacefully at her home on May 4, 2020. Judy was born on August 6, 1944, in Albany, Missouri, to the late Lawrence and Maxine Monger Sorensen. She graduated from North Kansas City High School in 1962, and shortly after graduation married Dale Camp on May 26, 1962, in Nashua, Missouri. They were blessed with their only child, Deborah. Judy was the personnel manager at Kmart for 20-plus years, retiring in 1998. She was a member of the Church of Christ, McPherson Ave. In addition to her parents, Judy was preceded in death by her son-in-law, Stephen Kinney, sister, Nancy Atala, and brother, Bill Sorensen. Judy is survived by her husband of nearly 58 years, Dale Camp, a daughter, Deborah Elam, all of Council Bluffs, grandchildren, Jonathan Kinney, Jessica Kinney, Cassandra Kinney, great-grandchildren, Kate Kinney, Kara Kinney, Gabriel Kinney, Maya Kinney, Mia Kinney, nieces and nephews. Open visitation Thursday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Private family funeral on Friday at the funeral home. Intermit Gardner Township Cemetery. Memorial contributions are suggested to the Tuberous Sclerosis Alliance, 8737 Colesville Road, Suite 400, Silver Springs, Maryland, 20910. The next is Billy Hannon. Billy D. Hannon, age 50, of Council Bluffs, passed away on May 2nd, 2020, at Nebraska Medicine in Omaha, Nebraska, from injuries suffered in a motorcycle accident near Crescent, Iowa. Billy was born May 24, 1969, in Council Bluffs, to Bill and Judy Williams Hannon, Sr. He was a member of Union Local 1140, working for J.E. Dunn Construction in Omaha. Bill was preceded in death by his father, Bill Hannon, Sr. He is survived by his wife, Laura Owen Hannon, children, Sean Strong, Amanda Strong, Danielle Strong, Nicholas Hannon, all of Council Bluffs, grandson, Harley Hall, and grandchild on arrival, mother, Julie Tolliman of Whitting, Iowa, brothers, Dallas Bailey of Carter Lake, Iowa, Jerry Hulin of Council Bluffs, sisters, Chris Kinneman of Lyons, Nebraska, Dennis Osborne, Kelly Mercick, and all of Council Bluffs. Many nieces and nephews. Open visitation Thursday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Private family funeral Friday at the funeral home. The family will direct memorial contributions. The next is Larry Heberlin. Larry Eugene Heberlin, age 79, of Macedonia, Iowa, went to meet his Lord Jesus on May 2nd, 2020. Those left to mourn him and cherish his memories include his wife of 60 years, Karen, his children, Rhonda Cron of Perry City, Iowa, Susan Herberling of Plentsville, and Beth Love of Macedonia, Iowa. Son-in-law Chris Scoville of Pleasantville, grandchildren Denise Scoville of Prairie City, Stacy Scoville of Des Moines, Iowa, Jessica Scoville of Newton, Iowa, Michael Adenbach of Adair, Iowa, James Love of Guthrie Center, Iowa, Jennifer Love and Zaya Love, both of Macedonia, 8 great-grandchildren, brother Stephen Heberlin of Indianola, Iowa, brother-in-law Richard Hunter of Pleasantville, Gary Fisher of Pleasantville, Barbara Gary Marchant of Indianola, many nieces and nephews and cousins. Funeral service, 2 p.m. Thursday, May 7th, at the Mason Funeral Home in Pleasantville. Burial will be in Pleasantville Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, please consider donating to the Pleasantville FFA or American Heart Association in memory of Larry. Online condolences at www.bertrandfuneralhomes.com. Mason Funeral Home, 902 North State Street, Pleasantville, Iowa, 50225. The last person on the list is Ronald Lamb. Ronald F. Lamb, born April 9, 1932, passed away on May 4, 2020, preceded in death by his son, Norman, brother Albert, survived by his wife of 67 years, Bethel, daughters Debbie Dottie, Monica Dustall, Brenda Michael, daughter-in-law Marcia Lamb, 10 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren, brother Larry Shirley Lamb, sister Barbara Shieldsman, many of other loving family and friends. Open visitation Thursday, 5 to 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel with COVID-19 restrictions in place. Private family funeral on Friday with the interment at Graceland Cemetery in Blanco, Iowa. Family funeral services will be live streamed at 11 a.m. Friday on the funeral home's website. Next, we will be reading a story from the sports section. Area coaches rely on social media creativity to instruct during COVID-19. This was written by Patrick Donahue, and it was posted on May 6th, 2020. 1 minute on the clock. A made basket is worth 3 points. A miss subtracts 2 points from the score. Best overall tally wins. How about a different 1 minute challenge? Shooters must make 5 layups worth 1 point, 5 free throws worth 2, and then spend the remaining time making as many top three of the key pointers possible. Best score wins. It may be the offseason, but Abraham Lincoln boys basketball team coach Jason Isaacson is doing everything he can to bring some fun to any of his followers on Twitter looking to scratch their competitive basketball itch. Isaacson has posted a series of challenges that competitors of all ages can try at home as long as they have a basket, a ball, and a desire to improve. The current situation kind of spurned it, Isaacson said. You're just trying to put yourself in the kids' shoes, and hopefully if they've got a ball and a hoop, they can still get some work done. You don't have our gun and shooting machines that have all types of stuff, so that you've got to find a way to get it done. Typically, the spring is time for basketball players to recoup, regroup, meet with coaches about upcoming year, and get in extra work during open gyms. Unfortunately, COVID-19 has prevented that, but Isaacson, his staff, and many other coaches in the area from all sports are finding new ways to teach their athletes from afar. We're thinking of everything possible, Isaacson said. Our guys led themselves through some Zoom weightlifting stuff. That's player-led. You almost have to give it to them and hope they're getting it done. We have come up with different leadership stuff. We give them assignments based on discipline and communication over some Google documents, and we're also asking them to break down game film from last year. Other high school athletes look to the spring as a time to prepare for summer sports. However, that plan has been abandoned as well this year. Spring sports in Iowa were canceled on April 17th. Practice for the summer seasons of baseball, softball were originally scheduled to begin May 4th, but at the moment, there's uncertainty on when or if the seasons will begin. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said the decision on her status of summer sports will be updated by June 1st. Until a concrete decision has been made, area coaches are trying to prepare for the season under some unique guidelines. All Iowa High School Athletic Associations and Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union activities are in the midst of a prohibitive period for practice, competition, and sanctioned activity. No in-person contact between coaches, administrators, and student athletes can take place. With those guidelines in place, Thomas Jefferson's softball coach Amy Anderson has become creative. With no practice Monday, Anderson went around town delivering softball survival packs to her players. Social distancing measures were respected, and even though the encounter was atypical, it provided Anderson with a chance to see her players and enjoy a fun moment together. Anderson also posts on her social media optional hitting and conditioning drills for her players can use to keep their skills sharp. Non-softball-related activities are also implemented. We have done a Google Hangout with our players, Anderson said, just making sure the kids know that they're on our minds a lot. We are thinking of them and seeing how they are all doing. It gives them a chance to talk to us as coaches and to their teammates. I think it's hard for them not seeing their friends as much. It was just a fun hour spent being goofy, talking, and hanging out. Safety is the main concern. All coaches know that. And it's why they've been so dedicated to the new virtual reality that practices have become. And the reason for the dedication is quite simple. Sports can be a vital part of life. Basketball, that's a part of my family too, Isaacson said. It's been good for my family at home, but I'm really missing my other family too. Another sports story. Three former Reavers signed with NFL teams. Again, it's by Patrick Donahue. It was posted April 28th, 2020. Add three more former Iowa Western football players to a growing list of former Reavers getting the chance to try out for an NFL roster spot. With offensive lineman Josh Nipfel, Anthony McKinney, and cornerback Hakeem Bailey signing free agent contracts over the weekend, a total of 26 former Reavers have now received a crack at playing at the highest level over the program's first 11 seasons. Nipfel signed with the Cincinnati Bengals. The 6'5", 305-pounder played for the Reavers in 2016 before moving on to Iowa State. He finished his college career with 39 straight starts and honorable mention All Big 12 honors in both his junior and senior years. Josh was kind of under-recruited and turned down some FCS offers out of high school, Iowa Western coach Scott Strohmeyer said. He had a knee injury, so he didn't get as heavily recruited. So to see him come here and play 1 year and then go to his dream school and be a three-year starter and now get a chance to play in the NFL, I'm happy for him and his family. McKinney signed with the Tennessee Titans. The 6'8", 314-pounder, who didn't start playing football until his junior year of high school, McKinney left Iowa Western Community College after the 2017 season and played for TCU, Texas Christian University. He started a combined 20 games and played a total of 24 over his junior and senior season. Anthony didn't play much high school football until much later in his career, Stroheimer said. He was a 6'6 wrestler, so he was really raw coming in and developed and worked really hard. He got his chance with hard work. Bailey signed with the Kansas City Chiefs, at 6 foot, 180 pounds. He played his redshirt freshman season in 2016 at Iowa Western before heading to West Virginia. He played 3 years at West Virginia, totaling 35 games with 21 starts, 134 tackles, and a spot on the academic All-Big 12 first team following both his junior and senior seasons. He came here because of academics and graduated in 18 months with a 3.4 GPA, Stroheimer said. He was really determined to get out academically and put himself in position to go play FBS ball. Now he has a chance in the league. He struggled in high school. To graduate here in 18 months, then be on the All-Big 12 academic team just shows that putting in the time and the effort academically, you can do it. Stroheimer is always proud to see his former players get an NFL chance, and it certainly helps on the recruiting front. It's great for the program, he said. We promote it. We're talking to kids right now, and those are some of the questions they ask. How many we send in Division I, and how many go to the NFL? The last article we will be reading is Stocks Open Higher on Wall Street as Nations Ease Lockdowns. This was posted in May 6, 2020, and is part of the national news. Stocks are opening higher on Wall Street as hopes for global economic recovery rise after more governments eased antivirus controls. The S&P 500 rose 0.8% in the first few minutes of trading Wednesday. Investors are also focusing on earnings reports by major U.S. companies. CVS Health rose after reporting a surge in profits as people rushed to fill medicine cabinets and pantries ahead of the arrival of the coronavirus. Bond yields rose but still remains extremely low. Crude oil prices fell. European markets were mixed after the region predicted a recession of historic proportions this year. This is a breaking news update, AP's earlier story below. Global stock markets are mostly higher Wednesday as hopes for economic recovery rose after more governments eased antivirus control. Indexes in London, Shanghai, and Hong Kong rose, and Wall Street futures pointed to a rise on the open. Japanese markets were closed for a holiday. Investors are increasingly optimistic as European countries and some U.S. states allow businesses to reopen despite warnings coronavirus infections still are rising in areas such as Brazil, and economic recovery could be some way off. U.S. President Donald Trump running for re-election during a slump that has thrown more than 30 million Americans out of work said Tuesday he wants the U.S. economy to reopen, but acknowledged some people will be badly affected. Asked whether there might be deaths as curbs ease, Trump told ABC News it's possible there will be some. The view that the benefit outweighs the cost has invited the market to largely shrug off the concerns here, despite Trump's acknowledgement of more fatalities, Jinji Pan of IG said in a report. In Europe, London's FTSE 100 gained 0.6 to 5,855. The DAX in Frankfurt rose 0.2 to 10,745. And France's CAC 40 lost 0.2% to 4,473 after the European Commission said it expects the economy of the 19-country Eurozone to shrink 7.75% this year, a recession of historic proportions. On Wall Street, futures for the benchmark S&P 500 index and Dow Jones and its industrial average were up 0.8%. In Asia, the Shanghai Composite Index climbed 0.3 to 2,878.14, and Hong Kong's Hang Seng added 1.1% to 24,137.48. The COPSI in Seoul was 1.8% higher at 1,928.76, and India's Sensex gained 1.2% to 31,830.43. Sydney's S&P-ASX 200 lost 0.4 to 5,384.60, Benchmarks in New Zealand and Singapore advanced while Jakarta declined. Bangkok was closed for the holiday. Many analysts are skeptical about the recent rally in stocks. They say it is overdone given the uncertainty of how long the recession will last, but the S&P 500 has recovered more than half of its losses in a sell-off earlier in the year. China, where the pandemic began in December, has allowed factories and some other businesses to reopen. France, Spain, and other European governments are taking similar steps. U.S. states, including Texas and South Carolina, have allowed restaurants and some other businesses to reopen. California might allow some retailers to resume serving customers this week. Still, the deputy chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, Richard Clarida, said Tuesday that the economy needs more support from the central bank and possibly additional government spending before it can recover. Hopes that economic revival will boost energy and demand has helped lift oil prices that have plunged to record-setting lows. Benchmark crude gained 84 cents to $25.40 per barrel in electronic trading on the New York Mercantile Exchange. The contract jumped from 20.5 on Tuesday to settle at $24.56. Brent crude, used to price international oils, rose 68 cents to $31.65 per barrel in London. It gained 13.9% the previous session to close at $30.97. The dollar declined from to 106.18 yen from Tuesday's 106.53 yen. The euro declined from 1.0810 from 1.0841. And that brings us to the end of today's reading for the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, May 6th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Irish volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Irish program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Will Hansen from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.